always teetering, precisely and ridiculously balanced with huge bundles and bags strapped to any available rusted crossbar. Robbie and I called him Hungry Jack, but we never asked him his name. Hungry Jack didn't have any front teeth. Hungry Jack fought in Vietnam. When he came through, Hungry Jack would stop and climb into the dumpster, dig around for things. Robbie and I caught him taking a shit one time, between the dumpster and the couch. I have read that the human memory for smells is one of the most powerful bits of data that can be etched into our brains. Although it seemed so foreign to me, being inside from attic to cellar in the middle of the night, the smell of the place was entirely familiar. The shop had this constant perfumed odor of sorrow, death, abandonment, condoms, and Bible verses. That was like nothing I'd ever smelled anywhere else. I felt as at home there as you'd have to feel lying in your own coffin. Johnny's things.
This way, I whispered.
Robbie had never set foot inside the secondhand store until that night. I'd told him about it enough times.
This is rather scary, Robbie said.
Now Robbie was speaking like a non-Ealingite.
Do you want to get out? No.
Robbie put his hand on my shoulder so he wouldn't trip on anything. I led him out around the back counter, which was a rectangular glass case where Johnny McKeon displayed watches, jewelry, cameras, guns, and three framed insect collections. There were only a few things in From Attic to Cellar that I favored. The insects were among my most appreciated abandoned items. One of the frames contained only butterflies. For some reason, I always found the butterflies to be boring. But the other two frames were wonders. One displayed 41 beetles. I counted them. There were all kinds of oddities in the frame, including beetles with horns, and some nearly as large as my clenched fist. The beetles in the center were posed so their shells were open and their glassine wings spread wide. The last frame had 15 bugs in it. An enormous centipede curled around the bend at one corner, and a glossy black scorpion raised its stinging tail in the other. Centered against the white backing board was a vampire bat with little beaded eyes, frozen with its mouth snarled open.
Isn't that the coolest shit? I asked.
Robbie said,
no.
Robbie remained attached to my shoulder, and I took him along the circular path around the main floor of the store. Johnny McKeon arranged From Attic to Cellar consignment store so that shoppers, or even people coming in to inquire about using the toilet, would have to walk a serpentine path from the front door to the back counter. His path led past every stack of clutter Johnny offered up for sale. Tipsy Cricket was different. At the liquor store, the counter was right up front, a deterrent to booze and cigarette thieves. Johnny McKeon was a good marketer.
I've never seen so much shit in my life, Robbie said.
There were nightstands on top of end tables stacked perilously on dinner tables. And every flat surface of every item of furniture was covered in figurines, place settings, ashtrays, silverware, toys, picture frames, clocks, crucifixes, candles, rock collections, pocket knives, and too many other things for me to list. I put the price tags on almost every one of them for Johnny, too. Johnny McKeon made a lot of money. As soon as one corner of the shop would empty out, it quickly filled back up again. A lot of the things came from realtors and loan agents. Some people in Ealing left behind what they couldn't fit in the trunks and back seats of their cars when the banks took their homes. Abandoned stuff from defeated Iowans had a way of migrating into Johnny McKeon's hands. Robbie's hand slipped from my shoulder. He said,
oops.
Objects clinked together in the dark. Figurines fell.
Be careful, I said.
Where are we going?
I want to see what Johnny's hiding, I said.
That scared Robbie. Robbie grabbed my hand.
Don't be such a baby, I said.
You wanted to come down here. I know where I'm going. Robbie started to let go of my hand.
It's okay, I said.
I pulled Robbie along by the hand like a little kid. Johnny McKeon kept things in his private office. He never let me go in there. Johnny never let anyone go in there. There were things Johnny wouldn't sell. One of them was a sealed glass globe he kept on a shelf beside the office door. I was fascinated by the globe. It had been made by some of the scientists in the lab at McKeon Industries and contained a perfectly balanced universe. There was water, land, plants, bacteria, a species of tiny shrimp, worms, and even some translucent fish in there. It was perfect. It was sealed and self-sustaining. Nothing got in, and nothing got out. My hand was wet and hot.
You're sweating all over me, I said to Robbie. Sorry.
I turned the knob to Johnny's office. Of course it was locked. Robbie bumped into me. He wasn't paying attention, and he pinned me flat against the office door with his chest.
No go, Robbie said. I guess we should get out of here.
I know where Johnny keeps the key. It isn't very smart, I said. Despite his creativity at naming businesses and his eye for marketing strategies, Johnny McKean wasn't that careful when it came to trusting teenage boys. History lesson. Teenage boys watch you, even when they pretend they don't give a shit about your life. Johnny kept the key resting flat on the lip of the molding at the top of the door. I pulled it down and unlocked our way into Johnny McKean's office, where he kept his secrets. Robbie said,
I really need a cigarette.
Two-headed boy. We stood inside Johnny McKean's private office. There were no windows. It was impossible to see anything in the dark. Robbie threw the switch for the office lights. I jumped when they came on. You don't expect things to get all bright on you when you're nervous about doing something you're not supposed to be doing. Robbie shrugged apologetically. He said,
We may as well turn on the light in here. Nobody can see us.
My heart raced, but Robbie was right. Nobody could see us. Robbie shut the door to the office, which closed us in with Johnny's things. Johnny McKeon's real-life horror show. Johnny McKeon's office smelled the same as the rest of the shop, but wasn't nearly as cluttered. In fact, the office was rather tidy. Rather. I said it again. The three walls boxing the office behind the door were lined with dark wooden shelves. Johnny had salvaged the shelves from the Ealing Public Library when it was remodeled 3 years before, the year we were in seventh grade.
Holy shit, Robbie said.
Here's why he said it. Johnny McKeon's shelves were full of horrible, grotesque things. They were the kinds of things that no 16-year-old boy could tear his eyes from. And there were four 16-year-old boy eyes in Johnny's office. One of the cases displayed another of the McKeon's sealed glass globes. But this was different from the peaceful and pleasant nature ball Johnny kept outside in the shop. The globe was about the size of a basketball, and it was propped steady atop a black lacquered stand with a brass plaque on front, as though it was some kind of trophy or shit like that. But this could not have been a trophy. The plaque read, McKeon Industries, 1969. Contained MI plague strain 412E. Inside the globe was a festering universe. The globe Robbie and I studied held something resembling a black, folded, and coiled brain. The thing clearly was not a brain, but the wrinkled patterns on its surface made me think of one.
This has to be like some kind of movie prop or something, Robbie said.
Look around, Rob. All the shit in here looks real, I said. In fact, everything inside Johnny's office was real, we came to find out later. It didn't matter. Neither of us actually believed Johnny McKeon was hiding away props for horror films. The black thing inside the globe pulsed and twitched like a beating heart. It seemed to become more animated the longer we stared at it. It was almost like a gelatinous cauliflower. Here and there on its velvet surface, a mound would rise up like a mosquito bite, a black pimple, and then burst open at its peak. Little volcanoes erupting. When the pimples burst open, strands of oval globules, pale yellow pearls, coiled and twisted over the surface of the blob, then turned black and sprouted velvet hairs, dissolving back into the surface of the brain thing. Where the glass globe with the fish, shrimp, plants, and worms outside in Johnny McKean's shop emanated a placid, almost hopeful aura, this thing whispered of rot and death, disease. Robbie and I could have stared at Johnny's secret collection of things all night. On another case was an assortment of large specimen jars. All of them had a common etched label. McKean Industries, 1969. Human replication strand 4VG03. One of them contained a human head. It was a man's head. His eyes were squinted, half open, and although they were clouded, his pupils and irises were plainly visible. He had pale blue eyes. I could even see small blood vessels in the whites of his eyes. He had a mustache. His lips were tightly pursed and frowning. He doesn't look too happy, I said.
This has to be fake, Robbie said. Who would keep shit like this?
Johnny McKeon would, I answered. He probably found it when the plant shut down and thought it was cool.
He could charge admission, Robbie said.
Another jar on the rack held a pair of human hands. The palms were pressed together. It reminded me of the trite-framed artwork depicting disembodied praying hands that hung at teenager eye level above the long urinal in the boys' toilet at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. The pictures were there to remind us what good teenage boys do with their hands. The jar beside the hands contained a penis and testicles. The position of the jars made an artistic statement about what happened to boys who masturbate.
"That guy probably went to Curtis Crane," Robbie said.
His voice shook with nervousness. There is nothing more deeply frightening to a 16-year-old boy than confronting the possibility of losing his penis. We had to leave, but we were mesmerized. But the thing on that particular rack that was most compelling was the jar containing a two-headed boy. It was a whole fetus, bluish in color and clay-like, tiny but fully developed. Robbie reached up and spun the jar around, making the boy pirouette for us as he floated in the zero gravity of his vacuum jar. His little legs were bowed and folded beneath him. A knotted umbilical strand corkscrewed from his round belly. One hand, its fingers so perfect, rested opened, palm up in front of the knob of his penis. The other hand was clenched in a defiant fist beside his hip. And from the boy's shoulder sprouted two perfect heads, one tilted to the side, resting. Both mouths were open, small black caverns that exposed the ridge of gums and the small rounded mounds of the boy's tongues. The eyes were open and hollow. Each plum-sized head was rimmed with a floating tuft of iron-colored hair. There was something overwhelmingly sad about the boy. I couldn't identify what it was. Robbie said,
"This isn't right."
I said, "I think I know exactly what it would be like to have two heads like that." The last wall contained specimens of bugs, but these weren't any bugs I'd ever seen. They also floated inside sealed rectangular glass cases filled with preserving fluid. They looked almost like aquariums with alien creatures in them. Some of the bugs in the tanks were as big as middle school kids. They looked like praying mantises, or grasshoppers maybe. The larger tanks only contained parts of bugs: heads, appendages, thoraxes. The heads were as large as mine and Robbie's. The tanks were also labeled McKeon Industries 1969, Unstoppable Soldier, Strand 4, VG-12.
"We need to get out of here," Robbie said.
I agreed. It was too late, though. Robbie and I were trapped in Johnny McKeon's office. Somebody was outside, in the main room of the shop. They weren't making any attempt to be quiet, either. Blue light.
"Oh, shit, Austin."
"Get the light," I whispered. Robbie flicked the switch, but Johnny McKeon's office didn't go dark. The glass globe with the pulsating black shit in it wriggled and burned with a blue light. It was like writhing cobalt embers trapped inside the sphere of the glass. The thing in the sphere, whatever it was, obviously responded to light. Hiding was our only option, but there was no place inside Johnny's office that was very suitable. Robbie pointed at the desk. We pulled Johnny's chair out and huddled together, hugging each other in the small rectangular space below the desk. We were just like that poor two-headed boy floating in fluid in the jar. We didn't even think to lock Johnny's office door behind us. Why would anyone have thought to do such a thing? Because it would have been smart, I told myself. The knob on the door squeaked and turned. There were footsteps. Someone came into the office. I put my face down on the floor and looked from under the desk. There were several sets of feet there. Someone said,
"What the crap is that?"
The shoes were positioned so whoever was inside with me and Robbie was looking at the mysterious globe.
"It's alive,"
another voice concluded.
"People always said Johnny McKeon kept weird shit in here. Maybe it's an alien or something."
Robbie's fingers squeezed around my arm. We both knew the voice. It was Grant Wallace. He and his boys had somehow gotten into from attic to cellar.
"Let's take that shit,"
the kid named Tyler said.
"You're carrying it. It looks heavy," Grant said. "I don't want that shit. I came for the booze. Let's go."
The Hoover boys apparently found their way into the back room connecting Tipsy Cricket with the secondhand store. They probably broke into the abandoned foot doctor's office to do it. It was a simple matter. For all anyone knew, Grant and his boys may have been planning their theft from Tipsy Cricket for a long time. It probably had everything to do with why we ran into them in Grasshopper Jungle earlier that day. Technically, our encounter with Grant Wallace happened the day before, since it was solidly past midnight in our time zone, which was located under the desk in Johnny McKeon's office.
"Is that a dick?"
one of the boys asked.
It's a dick, another concluded.
Johnny Mac has a dick in a bottle in his office, Grant affirmed.
Maybe it's his,
one of Grant's friends said.
Let's take it, another of them said.
I'm not touching it. It's a jar with a dick in it.
I think Tyler said that.
Oh, yeah,
someone else said.
And balls, too.
That's sick. I'm not touching it. Hang on. I'm going to take a picture of that dick in a jar with my phone,
the videographer decided.
Text it to me,
one of the Hoover boys laughed. I desperately wished they'd stop talking about the penis in the jar, but Grant and his friends were like lonely parakeets in front of a mirror. Finally, after they'd exhausted all speculation and conversational rhetoric on the topic of penises and jars, the boys stood there numbly for a moment, apparently unable to detach their eyes. I heard the sound of something heavy and solid sliding on one of the shelves. The blue shadows in the room swirled. Tyler had lifted the globe. It was not a good idea.
Let's go. I'm thirsty, he said.
They left the door to Johnny's office standing open. The blue light danced away into the darkness of the back room, and then faded entirely. I grabbed Robbie's wrist and pulled him out from our hiding place. Then I led him back through the shop and up the ladder to the roof. Priorities. Robbie Breeze and I had our priorities. As soon as we closed the hatch and we were outside on the roof again, we lit cigarettes. Smoking dynamos.
Shit,
Robbie said.
Shit,
I agreed. Shit, like the word okay, can mean any number of things. In fact, in the history I recorded in my book for that one Friday in Ealing, Iowa, I believe I used the word shit in every possible context. I will have to go back through the history and check. Robbie and I said shit, nothing else, approximately 11 more times as we smoked our cigarettes up on the roof.
What do you think that shit in the ball was?
Robbie said. I don't know. You read the nameplate on it. It said contained plague.
Nothing good is ever called plague,
Robbie said. Maybe it was just some glow-in-the-dark experimental stuff, I said.
I've done an experiment. We made a battery out of a lemon. Remember that?
Robbie asked. Yes, it was a good experiment, I agreed. I nodded like a scientist would. We knew what was supposed to happen before we even started it, and it worked.
But I don't think things called plague are the subject of the kinds of experiments we do in the lab at Curtis Crane,
Robbie said. That's what it was. What Robbie and I had done up there on the roof of Grasshopper Jungle, I thought. An experiment. It is perfectly normal for boys to experiment. I read it somewhere that was definitely not in a book at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. Or if it was in a book, it would certainly no longer be part of Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy's library collection. Not after the shit I did in eighth grade. Maybe I heard some psychologist who specialized in teen sexuality say shit about things like boys experimenting on one of those afternoon talk shows that are only on television for the fulfillment of depressed and lonely women. Depressed and lonely women need to know about teen sexuality and how it's normal for boys to experiment. Normal. That's what the psychologist would say. The psychologist also would have been a slim woman with nicely trimmed hair, a sincere and calming smile, and modest jewelry. That was bullshit. History shows that real experiments, like the one we did with the lemon, always involve some reasonable expectation ahead of time about the outcome, about how things will work out. Robbie slid the pack of cigarettes into the back pocket of his sagging jeans and we gathered up our flamingo, wine, grimacing lemur, and skateboards. We made our way down the ladder and onto the dumpster we'd rolled across Grasshopper Jungle.
Don't say anything to Shan, I cautioned.
I didn't need to tell Robbie that. It was just one of those things boys do sometimes to confirm that there are secrets that shall be protected. Robbie said,
You mean about what we saw in her stepdad's office? Or what we did up on the roof?
I said, Shit. I imagined I had two arguing and confused heads sprouting up from my shoulders. I felt sadness for that other boy inside the jar in Johnny McKeon's office. Hell breaks loose. Shan was sleeping soundly in the back seat of Robbie's Ford Explorer when we came back to the car. She stretched out comfortably, with her head lying on some crumpled socks and a pair of Robbie's boxers that had fire trucks and Dalmatians on them. Watching Shan sleep made me horny. I was all messed up. I thought I probably needed to talk to someone about how sexually confused I felt. I couldn't talk to Robbie about it, not after what we did on the roof. I thought, but only for half a second, about talking to Pastor Roland Duff, but I already felt guilty as it was. I thought I could talk to my father. It scared me to think about doing that, but my father would know what to tell me. He could help me sort things out. I just needed to work up the courage to start the conversation. Then everything would fall into place. Everything always falls into place that way.
Shan?
I whispered. I ran my hand up her leg to wake her. Shan opened her eyes slowly. She smiled at me. I felt guilty and sad.
Did you and Robbie already go?
She asked. I said yes, but didn't tell her we'd been gone for over an hour. It was nearly 2 a.m. Robbie opened the Explorer's rear gate and deposited our flamingo, the grimacing lemur head, skateboards, and wine bottles. He already held an unlit cigarette in his mouth when he got behind the wheel. Robbie passed the pack to me and started the engine. We lit both our cigarettes on the same orange-coiled moon burning at the end of the car's lighter. Our faces were so close, our cheeks touched. I looked Robbie straight in the eye as we leaned in to get the cigarettes going. It was awkward. I felt sad for Robbie. I turned around and reached back between the seats. I held Shan's hand. Behind her, I saw a glowing blue ball floating down the steps in back of the vacant podiatrist's office. Grant and the Hoover boys were coming out from the mall. I glanced at Robbie. I was certain he saw the same thing in the rearview mirror. We both knew better than to say anything and have Shan turn around. She would only start asking questions. Maybe she'd want to confront those punks. In a lot of ways, Shan was tougher than Robbie and me. Maybe the boys were already drunk. I can't be certain of it. But something happened to cause Tyler to let go of the glass globe. I watched the circle of blue light drop like a falling moon. Robbie coughed. Back in Grasshopper Jungle, blue light splattered everywhere.
I'm ready to go home, I said.
Yeah.
Robbie agreed. Robbie's hands gripped the wheel, but his eyes were pinned to the rearview mirror. Grant and his friends were the first victims of contained MI plague strain 412E. Nobody knew anything about it. Travis Pope and his wife, Eileen, had been hired by the association management of the Ealing Mall to clean the common areas every week. They drove through the lot Saturday mornings before sunrise, rarely doing anything about the debris that accumulated in the back alley of a soon-to-be-abandoned mall. That Saturday, Travis and Eileen stopped in Grasshopper Jungle and picked up large chunks of broken glass from the alley. Travis Pope tossed the shards into the dumpster somebody had pushed against the rear wall of the pancake house. Travis cursed the winos and delinquent kids in the town for getting drunk and fucking in public. Travis and Eileen Pope were the fifth and sixth victims of contained MI plague strain 412E. Nobody knew anything about it. And later that morning, an old man Robbie Breeze and I called Hungry Jack, who was missing his front teeth and had served in the United States Army in Vietnam, climbed into the dumpster we rolled across Grasshopper Jungle. The dumpster had pieces of Johnny McKeon's sick, broken universe inside it. Hungry Jack became the seventh victim of contained MI plague strain 412E. All hell had broken loose. It splattered across the piss-soaked pavement of Grasshopper Jungle. Nobody knew anything about it. History is full of shit. Every day I wrote in my books. I drew pictures, too. That night, I drew a plastic flamingo with a spike coming out of its ass, a grimacing lemur, bottles of wine, and a picture of me with my shorts pulled down around my knees. In my drawing, I was in the backseat of Robbie's Ford Explorer, lying on Shan Collins and some socks and a pair of my best friend's boxers that were printed with red fire trucks and spotted Dalmatian dogs. I drew a two-headed baby boy trapped inside a pickle jar. That night, I sat at my desk until the sky outside began to get light. I took off my shoes and socks, and my Orwell's t-shirt too. I always write more accurate accounts of history when wearing as little as possible. It's difficult to avoid the truth when you're undressed. My armpits reeked. I had serious BO. That was also true. Ingrid, my golden retriever, was in my bedroom. She liked to lie down beneath my desk so I could keep my bare feet in her fur. Ingrid, although she could shit better than any dog I knew, a real dynamo, never barked. When she was a puppy, she had a tumor on her neck. It made it so she couldn't bark, which helped me sneak into the house past curfew countless times. Our house got robbed twice, too. You're a good dog, Ingrid, I said. I wriggled my toes in her fur. I wrote. Even when I tried to tell everything that happened,
I knew my accounts were ultimately nothing more than an abbreviation. It's not that I neglected to write details. I told the truth about Shan's room, the staircase leading down to nothing, what the main ingredients of a Stan Prem pizza are. I wrote what it felt like to have my bare penis pressing upward against the cool skin of Shan Collins's thigh. That was also true. I told about Robbie kissing me. I described it in detail, down to the taste and feel of his tongue. I kept accurate count of the cigarettes we smoked, and described the things trapped inside the jars we found locked up in Johnny McKeon's office. But no historian could ever put everything that happened in a book. The book would be as big as the universe, and it would take multiple countless lifetimes to read. History necessarily had to be an abbreviation. Even those first men, obsessed with recording their history, who painted on cave walls in Lascaux and Altamira, only put the important details down. We killed this big hairy thing and that big hairy thing, and that was our day. You know what I mean. My name is an abbreviation. Three grandfathers back, a man named Kreis Szczerba came to the United States from Poland. People in America did not know what to do with all those consonants and shit in Kreis Szczerba's name. They decided to swap some out for vowels, and to take others away from Kreis Szczerba. So my three grandfathers back grandfather became Christopher Szczerba. I imagined. Sometimes I drew this picture. An official stone building. A repository for all the consonants and shit taken from refugees' names when they arrived on the doorstep of the United States of America. It is piled high everywhere with the letters we don't find useful. C's and Z's. And great heaping mounds that looked so much like the black and white photographs of luggage or shoes from World War II. Kreis Szczerba. History, and the United States of America, can call him Chris. History is full of shit like that. Kreis Szczerba came to America when he was 17 years old. In 1905, being 17 years old made you a man. In 1969, when Hungry Jack fought in Vietnam, 17 years old was a man. Now I wasn't so sure. My brother Eric, who was somewhere in Afghanistan, was 22. Kreis Szczerba came across the Atlantic with his father. They planned on working and earning enough money so Kreis's mother, brother, and two sisters could come to the United States too. People who did that were called bread Polacks. They came here to make money. Kreis Szczerba's father died on the boat in the middle of the ocean. His body was sent down naked into the water, with prayers and a medallion of St. Casimir. Kreis Szczerba's family never came to their son. Kreis Szczerba ended up in southern Minnesota, where he met a grocer's daughter named Eva Nightingale. Eva had breasts like frosted cupcakes and skin the color of homemade peach ice cream. Her body was a soft and generous pillow of endless desserts. Kreis Szczerba's semen found its way into Eva Nightingale's tummy, where it produced a good cigarette-smoking Catholic Polish boy named Unze. Sometimes when I wrote my history, I would slip in pages I drew about Kreis Szczerba and his lonely and sad life in the United States. It was hard for me, at times, to separate out the connections that crisscrossed like intersecting highways through and around my life in Ealing. It was the truth, and I had to get it down. And that was our day. You know what I mean. I took off my boxers and went to bed. It was 6:01 a.m. The end of the world was about 4 hours old. Just a baby. Johnny McKeon was picking up 2 dozen donuts at that moment. Olle Jungfrau was waking up, trying to decide if he should masturbate or not. It was just after 3 in the afternoon in Afghanistan. Louis, the Chinese cook at the pancake house, whose real name was Ah Wong Sing, was taking a shit in the public restroom at the Ealing Coin Wash Laundrette. History never tells about people taking shits. I can't for a moment believe that guys like Theodore Roosevelt or Winston Churchill never took a shit. History always abbreviates out the shit-taking and excess consonants. In about a week, the pieces started coming together. In a week, we figured out history. Eventually, we would learn this. The thing inside the globe, the contained MI plague strain 412E, wasn't anything remarkable unless it came into contact with human blood. Contained MI plague strain 412E really was contained and harmless inside Johnny McKeon's glass universe. Tyler dropped that universe directly onto the spot where earlier that day Robbie Breeze began spelling out Grant Wallace murdered me in his own blood. The contained MI plague strain 412E was happy to meet Robbie Breeze's blood. Robbie Breeze was my best friend. He taught me how to dance. We smoked cigarettes. He kissed me. To be honest, I kissed him back.
Robbie was homosexual. I didn't know if I was anything. I wondered what I was. None of that mattered. Nobody knew anything about it except for me and Robbie. The man whose scientific company invented the contained MI plague strain 412E died when his plane crashed into the ocean. The plane's engines were destroyed by billowing plumes of caustic ash. The ash came from a volcano in Guatemala. It was called Huacamoctli. Robbie Breeze's dad was filming the Huacamoctli eruption at precisely the same moment that Dr. Grady McKeon's jet disintegrated on impact with the surface of the Gulf of Mexico. Water is unyielding when you're moving at 500 miles per hour. We were in seventh grade then. My brother, Eric Christopher Zerba, joined the United States Marines that year. At the same moment Huacamoctli was being filmed by Robbie's father and Dr. Grady McKeon's body was being torn apart by the force of impact, my brother Eric was on his way to boot camp. Robbie Breeze's dad never came back to Ealing, Iowa. He didn't want to see Robbie's mom ever again. We found this out later. The contained MI plague strain 412E said hello to Robbie Breeze's blood on the asphalt in Grasshopper Jungle. And the end of the world began at about 2 a.m., around 3.5 feet away from a discarded floral print sleeper sofa infested with pubic lice in Ealing, Iowa. One time, Travis Pope unfolded the sofa and fucked his wife Eileen on it. Both of them had pubic lice. It didn't matter. History is my compulsion. I see the connections. Part 2. Waterloo Cornfield. Palindromes. Chris Sterba was Catholic. He smoked cigarettes. Christopher Sterba was Catholic. He did not give up smoking cigarettes when he gave up the excess consonants. All the Zerba boys were cigarette-smoking Catholics until my father fell in love with my mother and married her. He quit smoking, converted, and as a result, his semen created two strong Lutheran sons inside her body. Their names were Eric Christopher and Austin Unze Zerba. My dad picked up some discarded consonants from the waste pile of history. It is pronounced Unze. Don't ask me why. It's Polish and shit. I smoke cigarettes. I hate church. But one day, after I talk to my father about my confusing sexual impulses, I will change my name back to Sterba. My father's name was Eric Andrew Zerba. My mother was Connie Kenny before she married him. People from Iowa like vowels and rhymes. Lutherans in Iowa like John Deere tractors and big breakfasts on Saturdays. Usually, my dad would only have to stand outside my door and speak my name to get me out of bed for our Saturday breakfast. That morning, the morning after Robbie and I went up on the roof of the Ealing Mall to find some shit, my father had to come into my room and shake my shoulder. "You stink, Austin," my father, whose name was Eric, told me. "I have B.O., I agreed. "Ingrid needs to shit," my father said. That was how we told each other good morning that day. I sat up. I would have gotten out of bed, but I realized I was naked under the sheet. I'd taken everything off when I finished writing, when I went to bed. No 16-year-old boy wants to stand up naked in front of his father. I thought about my decision to talk to him. I wanted to ask him if maybe he was confused about sexual attraction when he was my age. Or if maybe he was still confused about sexual attraction. Experimenting. Things falling into place. Where else would things fall if not a place? It's not like things are just going to float away. Gravity works. Dr. Grady McKeon certainly knew that when he was watching the Gulf of Mexico get closer and closer and closer. Maybe the guys who painted the caves in Lascaux and Altamira were sexually confused too. I could not bring myself to talk to my father about sexuality while I was naked. I decided it could wait. Things would have to float a little while longer. My father could tell I was naked. He watched me, like he was testing to see if I would get out from under the sheet. But I was naked. I wasn't going anywhere. We watched each other, both of us caught up in eyeballing the palindrome of each other's lives. My mother took an anti-anxiety drug called Xanax. It was a little blue pill that looked like a tiny kayak. Robbie's mother took it too. Our moms were like Xanax sisters, except they didn't know much more about each other than first names, who their baby boy's best friends were, and Ealing gossip. Kayak and Xanax are palindromes. Robbie's mother was named Connie, too. It was always fascinating to me how perfect things could be if you just let all the connections happen. My history showed how everything connected in Ealing, Iowa. You could never get everything in a book. Good books are always about everything. My mother would take her anti-anxiety drug when she felt stress or panic setting in. Saturday mornings usually meant no drugs. She took her drugs in the afternoons, on holidays, and whenever we had visiting human beings at the house. Dad?
Yes, Austin?
Would you please let Ingrid outside for me so she can shit?
No problem, son.
I got out of bed and pulled on some shorts. I stunk. My phone was lying on the floor, under the rumpled boxers I wore the day before. No fire trucks and dogs. They were blue plaid. Iowa was blue plaid. That is the truth. The battery in my phone was nearly dead. At 3:45 a.m., I received a text message from Robbie. It said, "I'm sorry, Austin." Robbie and I always used punctuation and spelling in text messages. We both despised abbreviations. I sent him a message in reply. "Don't be dumb, Robbie." I was certain Robbie was asleep at that precise moment. I felt bad for calling him dumb. Like maybe he would take it the wrong way and not know if I meant dumb for asking to kiss me or dumb for being sorry, which is what I meant. So I sent him another message. "You shouldn't worry about me, Rob. Let's talk and have a fag later. Ha ha. Now relax and come meet me at Satan's after I get off at 5. Bring boards." I was so confused. That was true. A bath, a shave, and modesty. I am Polish. My hair is the color of potato peels, and I have skin the shade of boxed oatmeal. Food descriptions work well in Iowa. Polish kids have natural and persistent bags under their eyes. I think we evolved through a lot of sleepless nights or shit like that. If you read the history of Poland, which I have done, you'd probably just shake your head and say, "That is full of shit." I am Kreese Szczerba's great-great-grandson. That is the only thing I know about myself with absolute certainty. I think I would like to smoke a cigarette with him. I have a feeling Kreese Szczerba could cuss, had hair the color of russet potatoes, and Quaker oat skin, just like me. I feel like I could ask him anything. He would tell me what to do. He came to America when Theodore Roosevelt, a man who apparently never took a shit in his life, was president. Connie, my mother, drove me to work at Johnny McKeon's from attic to cellar consignment store that morning. I did not have a big Lutheran Saturday breakfast with my mother and father because I needed a bath more. On Saturdays, I shave. I did not actually need to shave. It was something that boys in Iowa start doing when they are 16, regardless of necessity. I ran the tip of my finger around my lips before applying the shaving cream. Robbie's lips had some spiny little whiskers around them. I felt them when we kissed. I found the feeling to be a little unexpected. Also, his lips were thinner, not as heavy as Shan's. I never thought about it before, how maybe Shan felt spiny little whiskers around my thin, unmeaty lips when we kissed. I was disgusted with myself. I called Shan while the bathtub was filling, and I sat on the toilet, locked inside the bathroom. My mother and father ate their big Lutheran Saturday breakfast downstairs. I told Shan I loved her. She said she loved me. I was naked, so I knew I was telling the truth. Also, Shan did not say I love you too. Everyone knows I love you too does not mean I love you. The two makes it a concession, a gesture, an instinct of politeness. History lesson for the morning. I turned the water off and slid into the tub. My face began to sweat. "I am in the bathtub, Shan," I said.
"Are you naked?" she asked.
"Well, I would be normally," I said. "But since I knew I would be talking to you, I went out and slipped into a modest bathing suit." She knew I was kidding. It made me very horny to admit to her that I was, indeed, fully naked. "I am totally naked," I admitted. Shan told me that she slept well, that she was not scared in her new old bedroom as she thought she would be. But, she said, at exactly 6 a.m., there came a ticking sound from inside her wall. Shan explained that it sounded like a typewriter. "Nobody uses typewriters anymore," I told her. At exactly 6:01 a.m., I was taking off all my clothes and going to bed. Johnny McKeon was buying donuts. The contained MI plague strain 412E was dying off, but managed to wriggle around on 3 slices of Stan Prime pizza we threw in the dumpster, where it wormed its way down the esophagus of its last initial carrier, a homeless man named Hungry Jack, who participated in the killing of an entire village of women, elderly people, and children in Vietnam. Ali Jungfrau was probably masturbating. Ah Wong Sing was taking a shit. Something was ticking inside Shan Collins' wall. She said the ticking stopped after a moment. Shan used words like moment. The way she talked made me horny. I told her if the ticking came again, maybe she could record it on her phone because I'd like to hear it. She told me she would do that. I shaved.
The pancake house is busy this morning, my mother said when she pulled into the front lot of the Ealing Mall.
Then she said,
we should eat breakfast there sometime.
Okay, Mom, I said. If you want a donut, Johnny always brings coffee and donuts in for me and Ollie Jungfrau on Saturdays.
Johnny McKeon is such a nice man, my mother said.
Yes, I agreed. Johnny takes good care of us. She parked almost as far away from the secondhand store as you could get and still be on Kimber Drive. My mother was not very steady-handed at squeezing our Chevrolet between slotted cars and parking lots. I wore a Modest Mouse t-shirt, the shoes we salvaged from the roof of the mall the night before, clean boxers, Iowa plaid, and loose 501s with a belt. I smelled good. My hair was still wet from the bath I took. I did not like my jeans to droop like Robbie did. Boys at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy were required to wear belts and matching socks. We would be called into Pastor Roland Duff's office if our underwear showed. Lutherans in Iowa are very modest.
What is a modest mouse? My mother asked.
She had a stretchy thing on her hair. It was green and looked like the waistband from a pair of fat guy's underwear. I didn't know what those things were called. You know, women from Iowa wear them. And their hair. Her nails needed a new coat of paint. They were chipped or grown out around the edges. Apparently, my mother's nails grew much faster than mine did. Real dynamos. She wore a green velour tracksuit with a zip-up top. I guessed it would be called a tracksuit. I'd never seen my mother run one time in my life. Who wants to run when you can kayak everywhere? Nothing, I said. I don't know. She parked the Suburban facing out toward the street, directly across from Satan's Pizza. My mother was very calm that morning. Maybe all I needed was a tiny blue kayak to get things to fall into place for me. I decided I would ask Robbie if he'd ever gone kayaking on one of his mother's Xanax before. Probably not. Like me, Robbie never even got drunk before. But we could smoke cigarettes like real dynamos.
Do you need one of us to come pick you up, sweetie?
She asked. My mother called me sweetie when she was calm. When she said one of us, it meant that she anticipated being drugged out by five, and my dad could come get me. History does show that more of what we actually say is not contained in words anyway. It's why those cave guys simply stuck to the pictures of big hairy things and shit like that. Robbie and I are going skating, I said. I'll call if I'm going to be late for dinner. My mother leaned over and kissed me. Johnny and Ollie. It's about time you met these two. Ollie Jungfrau lifted half a maple bar to me when I walked through the door to From Attic to Cellar Consignment Store. It was the kind of gesture drunken soldiers at a bar would make when weary battlefield comrades came in from the war looking for a drink. But it was with half a donut.
Hey, Dynamo, Ollie said, winking at me.
Ollie Jungfrau called me Dynamo. The first time he said it, I had to look it up. Who says Dynamo? People in Ealing, Iowa do, that's who. That's another word I'm going to try to erase from history. Never say it again. But it is a challenging redirection. I'm from Ealing, Iowa, after all. I rather wished Robbie was there, so we could go have a cigarette. Hey, Ollie, I said. Ollie panted contemplatively between bites of his donut. He had red stuff on his chin. The front lines of jelly donuts had already been decimated by the Panzer Division of Ollie's appetite.
Coffee.
Ollie waved his hand gracefully between a tall paper cup and me, as though he were introducing blind dates at a barn dance. Thanks, I said. Appreciative of my date's quiet demeanor. Coffee is a girl who never tells boys no. The idea of such a compliant partner normally would have made me horny, but I was too hungry, still sleepy, and I was also watching Ollie Jungfrau eat a donut at the exact moment sexual thoughts involving a quiet girl at an Iowa barn dance occurred to me. I liked coffee and cigarettes. Neither of these truths were welcome at my home. I did not like jelly donuts, however. All the more for Ollie and the customers. Jelly only belongs in one place. Two, if you have decent toast, I suppose. History.
Johnny,
Ollie called out in the direction of Johnny McKeon's office.
The kid's here.
I heard Johnny moving things around in the back of the shop.
I had already confirmed to myself that I did not feel guilty about being in the shop at night. I was an employee. Robbie and I didn't do anything wrong. Well, we didn't do anything wrong inside the store, at least. What Grant Wallace and those other boys did would have happened whether or not Robbie and I were there to see it. So I did not feel guilty about the below-the-roof part of the night. I sat down across the display counter from Ollie and selected a white frosted cake donut with blue and yellow Iowa plaid sprinkles that scattered a candy galaxy over its surface. Ollie nodded. He had an expression on his face like a saint receiving a vision of a bloodied Jesus. Ollie Jungfrau would have been the patron saint of donuts. Not that I'm allowed to believe in saints. I did not believe in Jesus either, even if he was good at picking donuts. I was not allowed to say that either. I might not put that shit down in the book.
Good choice, Ollie said.
It was calling my name, Ollie, I said.
A voice like an angel.
Ollie took his donuts seriously. Johnny McKeon looked agitated. He stood beside Ollie at the counter, with his palms flat on the glass and his elbows locked straight. Johnny was a giraffe of a man, and his hands looked like twin octopi. I had never seen anyone with fingers as long as Johnny McKeon's. If Johnny McKeon ever gave you the thumb and index finger international gesture for okay, trained poodles could jump through it. Maybe even dolphins. I looked past his fingers at the vampire bat and bugs in the collections below our donuts. Most people would probably not want to eat donuts here. Good morning, Johnny, I said. Sometimes I would say something corny like, hey-ho, Johnny. But not today. Johnny McKeon said,
is it still morning?
That was what Johnny always said to me. Johnny McKeon was a mover. He was out of bed every day by 5. He got things done. I liked him very much, and he knew that. Johnny was aware I smoked cigarettes, too. He'd get mad at me for it, but he'd also sometimes give me free smokes when he broke up vendor multi-pack specials at Tipsy Cricket.
If your dad or mom tells me anything about this, I'm saying you stole them,
is what he always said to me, too. That morning, Johnny McKeon said to me,
I'm going to leave you in charge of the store this morning, Austin. You can handle it. I need to run into Waterloo and pick up some plywood and stuff. Some a-hole broke in through the podiatrist's last night.
Johnny never cussed. He had to be pretty mad to say something as daring as a-hole. Someone broke in? I echoed.
Yeah, Johnny said. Right through the dang wall.
I looked at Ollie Jungfrau. He was eating a glazed bow tie and nodding. Apparently, he knew all the details. Naturally, he would. It was Saturday, donut day, and Ollie always showed up first, before Tipsy Cricket was supposed to open.
Sign of the times,
Ollie analyzed, shaking his head in a grim, I saw this coming rhythm. Did you call the police? I asked. My heartbeat accelerated. The coffee made me sweat. Under my armpits, the chemical beads of my deodorant stick began to erupt like miniature laboratory volcanoes. Outside in Grasshopper Jungle, the contained MI plague strain 412E was now completely dead, having moved into the bodies of 7 hosts. Robbie Breeze was asleep in his bed at the Del Vista Arms. Ingrid was taking a shit.
They were here all morning. What can you do?
Johnny said.
You should have a video system. You should have an alarm, they said. But this is Ealing.
There never was anything worth filming in Ealing, unless you were one of Grant Wallace's buddies watching him kick the shit out of a couple candy cane faggots. In Iowa, there are cameras trained on cornfields, so you can watch corn grow. My house has been robbed, I said, because my dog can't bark. I should teach her to shit on people. Ollie chewed thoughtfully.
My uncle has a German shepherd who will do that. He only takes commands in German. Scheiß, Dieter, scheiß! And he'll toast a brownie on the spot.
Ollie Jungfrau was full of scheiß.
Did they take anything? I asked.
Johnny said,
a case of Gilby's gin. And the Sons of Guns got into my office, too. They took a display I had in there.
I sipped my coffee and looked at the candy galaxy on my donut. It hovered on a perfect plane of glass above a rhinoceros beetle. Johnny went on without any prodding.
I had one of those glass globes the scientists at MI made. It had this photoluminescent mold sealed up inside it. I really liked that thing. It made the nicest blue glow if I'd turn the lights on it at nighttime.
Whoa, 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 Ollie objected. What kind of mold?
Photoluminescent, Johnny repeated.
Ollie took a bite of donut and shook his head rapidly.
Nope, no such word, he decided.
Ollie graduated from Herbert Hoover High School, 3rd in his class.
Ollie Jungfrau was a tool.
I think it means glow in the dark, I said.
Ollie unrolled his glazed fingers. He was counting something.
Then why wouldn't you just say glow in the dark, Johnny? It has less syllables.
Was it, valuable? I asked.
Nah, Johnny said. I don't think so. How would I know? It was just part of the crazy stuff from boxes that got delivered to me after MI shut down. I don't know anything about it.
Johnny reached below the counter and found a metal-cased Stanley tape measure. He placed this and a pencil on top of a pad of lined paper and slid the pile across the display case toward my coffee cup. Johnny said,
Bring this stuff, Austin. I need you to come back and help me take measurements so I can fix the danged wall, so they won't ever do something like that again.
They weren't ever going to do it again, plywood or not. Nobody knew that either. The patch job. This is how history works. It is omniscient. Everyone trusts history. Think about it. When we read history books, nobody ever asks, how did you find this out if it happened before you were born? History is unimpeachable, sublime. It is my job. I can tell you things that nobody could possibly know because I am the recorder. I found out everything in time, but I'm abbreviating, cutting out the shit. You have to trust me. This is history. You know what I mean. Why wouldn't you trust me? I admitted everything. Think of how embarrassing these truths are to me. Most of what I found out came to me much later, after the end of the world, when Robbie and I would go out on cigarette runs. You will see. I did the work of history, what I am supposed to do. I found clues and artifacts everywhere, put them together, and I found out exactly what happened. This is why you can trust me. I couldn't begin to explain why things happened. Why isn't my job? I would love to talk to Kreese Sterba, or even my own father. They might know. They could tell me why I am the way I am. All I can do is keep my lists of what happened. That's what I do. And that was our day. You know what I mean. I considered telling Johnny McKeon about Grant Wallace and the Hoover Boys. It scared me to imagine what could possibly happen. Nothing good might come of it, I thought. Shan would ask why Robbie and I didn't say anything to her when we left Grasshopper Jungle. She would know something was wrong with me. I would spill my guts. Spilling my guts is how history gets recorded. Shan would find shit out. When I thought about bad things happening between me and Robbie and Shan, I could feel my balls shriveling up inside my body. That's the truth. History lesson for the day. My balls are barometers to emotional storms. So I helped Johnny McKeon measure the wall at the spot the Hoover Boys dug through so they could get inside the back room. I held the zero end of the tape measure, and Johnny pulled out the tape and called off numbers to me, which I recorded in pencil on my pad of paper, like cave painters in France. What kind of crazy stuff? I asked. I suppose I'd been having an imaginary conversation in my head. Johnny said,
What?
I mean, what kind of crazy stuff came in the boxes from MI after they closed down?
Oh.
Johnny made another mark on the wall.
I can't believe they actually knocked out a stud just to get some cheap gin. It was mostly things from experiments they were doing, I guess, from my brother's storage unit. It was a bunch of junk of his I inherited, I guess, but never looked at until the place got all packed up. To be honest, I didn't know what to do with the stuff. There was so much of it, I threw some away. I put stuff in the office. I even put some of it on the roof. I don't know what I was thinking, but it was my brother's, you know? Go figure. So, eh.
Oh, I said. I like experiments. Do you think I could see them sometime? I felt like asking Johnny McKeon how the little boy with two heads was getting on. Johnny shrugged.
Eh. Maybe sometime, Austin. It's kind of, well, morbid stuff, if you ask me.
Sounds like it could be cool, I said.
Eh,
Johnny said. We measured. Johnny recited numbers and items, like half-inch plywood, studs, drywall mud, and tape, and shit like that. It sounded incredibly manly. My balls felt bigger just writing that shit down. I printed in uppercase. It was manly. Hey, Johnny, I said. Tonight I'd like to take Shan out to dinner and a movie, maybe to Waterloo. Would that be okay?
What are you, asking permission to take your girlfriend on a date?
Johnny said. No, I'm asking for a ride. Do you think you could give us a ride?
Do I get to go to the show, too? I could sit in the middle,
Johnny said.
He was teasing.
Don't you think it's about time you get your driver's license?
I turned 16 in February. It was a week until the beginning of May. My mom and dad don't want me to drive yet.
That should do it,
Johnny said, and rolled up the tape measure.
Sure, I'll take you kids. Only not too late. I don't want to have to come pick you up in Waterloo after midnight.
I'll be at your house around 6, I said. Thanks, Johnny.
Say please.
Waterloo, Iowa sprawled along the Cedar River, 20 miles away from Ealing. Johnny McKeon took my notes and the shopping list he'd dictated and put me in charge of from attic to cellar. It made me feel something, something with big balls, to know that Johnny trusted me, even if I did intend to go back and see if he still kept his office key on the trim molding above the door. I was also planning on smoking at least one cigarette, too. I rarely smoked alone, but I needed one. In truth, until that day, I never smoked alone. I'd just have to toughen up and go buy a pack from the tool in the liquor store. Ollie Jungfrau left when it was time to open Tipsy Cricket, which didn't have a fixed schedule. Opening the liquor store happened once there were 2 or 3 people waiting outside the door. Usually, they'd tap on the glass with quarters or car keys to let Ollie and Johnny know there were thirsty Iowans with money who needed to spend it on alcohol. The secondhand store, as always, smelled like insecticide, condoms, and despair, with a little sweet hint of unanswered prayers, formaldehyde, cardboard donut boxes, and chicory all mixed in. I waited a few minutes, just to be sure Johnny wouldn't double back after something he'd forgotten. Then I slipped through the back room to the pale green linoleum and fluorescent lights of Tipsy Cricket Liquors. I made plenty of noise tracking my way through the back room. I did not want to startle Ollie Jungfrau, or catch him looking at computer porn or masturbating behind the counter. Making noise was the polite thing to do.
Scared to be alone, Dynamo?
Ollie grinned at me sympathetically when he saw my intentionally clumsy entrance near the beer cooler and back. No, I said with efficient curtness. I was all business and could not waste time. I did not want to let Johnny down. Ollie Jungfrau played games on a laptop computer tapped into the wireless network from Johnny's office. He played all day long while he sat behind the counter at Tipsy Cricket. I did not see the allure of that particular pastime. But for a guy like Ollie, having his ego sucked into the fantasy of being a muscular soldier in tight clothing, trapped aboard a space station infested by aliens, was preferable to rooting his identity in the here and now. Ollie Jungfrau killed thousands of aliens every day. It made him horny.
By the way, Ollie said, I looked up photoluminescent on the computer. It means glow in the dark.
Okay, I agreed.
That's stupid, Ollie decided.
Ollie Jungfrau never took his eyes from his laptop screen while we talked. He shot something with a spastic swipe at the spacebar, or some shit like that. The thing on Ollie's screen howled in pain. Its leg came off. Ollie laughed and put his game on pause. He was sweating. I came over to buy some cigarettes, I said.
For whom?
Ollie asked.
Me. I think it's I.
Me.
What would your parents say?
That was a pointless question, I thought. Why would Ollie Jungfrau ever want to insinuate himself into a conversation between me and my parents regarding cigarettes? So I said, they would tell I to say please. A snapshot. Ollie sold me the cigarettes I asked for. I wanted to show Robbie how brave and independent I could be. I bought 2 packs and a disposable lighter, then went back to the shop. My balls were big. I called Shan minutes before noon. I asked her if she'd like to see a movie and have dinner with me in Waterloo that night.
What about Robbie? She asked.
Robbie's fine, I answered. And how's your mom?
Fine, Shan said. What are you talking about?
I thought you were just making small talk about other townsfolk we know, I said.
No, I mean, are we all 3 hanging out tonight?
This isn't about Robbie. I was planning on just me and you having a date, Shan, I said. Johnny told me he'd drive us and everything. Johnny McKeon wouldn't mind if Shan and I sat together in the back seat for the drive. It was a long, straight road to Waterloo. The thought of having sex with Shan in the car while her stepfather drove us to Waterloo made me very horny. Then the shop's front door opened. A family of tourists. A man, woman, and their identically clothed, identical twin boys who looked to be about 6 years old and undoubtedly had identically stinky feet, as Robbie would confirm,
came in and began their family expedition along Johnny's path of wonder and despair. They marched through the maze in parade fashion. The mother, up front, regulated the speed. She stopped from time to time to admire a cow creamer or an iron trivet shaped like a squashed rooster. She pulled out drawers on dressers and nightstands. She wasn't going to find any condoms. A couple drawers still had Bibles in them. The twin boys followed, shoulder to shoulder, holding hands. If they got a little closer to each other, they would look just like the boy in the jar Johnny McKeon kept inside the office. The father held up the rear of the parade. He had a canvas satchel, a man purse, Robbie and I called them, strapped diagonally across his shoulders. They definitely were not from Iowa, I thought. Maybe Minneapolis. It wasn't unusual for tourists to stop at From Attic to Cellar on Saturdays. This family was probably on their way to the ocean and found themselves trapped in the center of an enormous continent. They may have been looking for postcards so they could mail out desperate messages like, "Send help now!" And that was our day. You know what I mean. But Johnny McKeon did not sell postcards at From Attic to Cellar consignment store. He did, however, sell condoms at Tipsy Cricket Liquors. I think most of the condoms he sold ended up stuck to the floor of the Ealing Coin Wash Laundrette, or in dresser drawers and nightstands that I cleaned out when their owners lost homes and hope. And that is an economic snapshot of the United States of America and a dying Iowa town.
"It would be so nice to go out on a date, just you and me, Austin," Shan said.
"It's not like we never do that, Shan," I explained. The family snaked their way closer to me at the counter. Along the way, the mother had picked up some objects.
"I know," Shan said. "But it's, well, different now, don't you think?"
My heart beat faster.
"Oh,"
I said. "Yes." I didn't know what she meant. I suddenly felt guilty again, like Shan knew everything.
"I love you, Austin,"
Shan said. Then I got it. I understood. I was relieved and stupid at the same time.
"I love you, Shan."
I did not say two, but I was fully clothed anyway. "Did I tell you I am alone at the shop?" Johnny needed to go to Waterloo to pick up some things. There are customers here. I eyeballed the two packs of cigarettes I stacked on the glass case above my favorite insect collection.
"Austin?"
"What?"
"That ticking noise is happening again," she said. She sounded